Hi, group. My name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic. Friday, June the 5th of 94. I'm as thankful as I know how to be for that today. You know, a lot of people start with their childhood and all that kind of thing, and I just don't, because that's boring to me when people start that away. Other than to say, I always say I come from a good family. I really did. My folks raised a preacher and a missionary, and my sister is almost an angel, and I was the only sorry one in the bunch, you know, and I kind of blazed the trail to hell, and everybody else went the other way. They went to church. Don't know how that happened. You know, the only thing I know about being alcoholic is the way I drink alcohol. And the only thing I know about staying sober is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's that simple. I'm going to share with you in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I want to thank the committee for inviting me. It's always an honor and a privilege to get to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you come from where I come from, to get to do anything, is just it's a miracle. It's an absolute miracle. So I'm going to get started with my favorite day of my life. I was about 10 or 11 years old. I was walking home from school one day, and a friend of mine, Jamie, said, if we're going to be real men, we've got to dip Copenhagen snuff. And I said, by God, you're right. And I got a big old dip in my mouth, made about 3 or 4 steps, and I've been doing it ever since, you know. Got to his house later on that afternoon, and he said, if we're going to be real men, we've got to drink whiskey. And I said, by God, you're right. And he got this bottle of Jim Beam. I'll never forget it as long as I live. I can tell you everything I was wearing that day, everything that happened. Total recall of that day. He poured a shot, and I looked at it. Never hadn't taken a drink in my life. I said, you know what? That's not going to be enough. And that's the truth. So we got this plastic cup. We filled it about halfway up, and I got that juice down the hole where it does most good. And let me tell you, I felt just like a man ought to feel. I wanted to go kill somebody, find me a girl, roll around in the hay, and fight, you know. And I thought, I have arrived. And I thought to myself, I'm going to do this every day for the rest of my life. I can't wait till I get grown. I can get this done on a regular basis. Half my family is Irish Catholic, and the other half is the Assembly of God, folks. So I was confused, and you can just tell from the start which side I fit in best with, you know. I like the drinkers. So anyway, all my people are on my dad's side, which is the Catholic side, are up in Kansas City, and I was my first drunk was a whole lot like my last. I was with all the people I wanted to be with, doing exactly what I wanted to be doing, and I overshot the mark and got sent home the next day. That's how that works. So we're up there, and my cousin is on home leave from the Navy, and he said, what would you like to drink? And got this big old plastic cup, and I said, man, just pour a little bit of everything in there. And he did, and God, it was wonderful. The last thing I remember was passing out making snow angels in the front yard, blacking out and passing out. You know, that's just how it went. Right after midnight mass, it was great. Got up the next morning, I was still drunk and nobody seemed to notice, and got back home, and man, I was just looking forward to it. I grew up in a small town. I lived in Fort Worth for a long time, and they think anything east of 360 is East Texas. Kind of like y'all down here think everything north of 10 is Yankeesville, you know? Kind of the same thing. I say I'm from East because it just makes sense because I talk so funny, and it just kind of explains it a little bit. But grew up in a small town, and it's never hard to find somebody to buy you a little booze, or somebody's always got an older brother or sister. Somebody's house is fortified. I wasn't from a real drinking family, but I never had a problem getting a hold of alcohol. And from the beginning, it seemed like I had a great capacity for it. It seemed like, you know, we'd get a 12-pack of beer with my buddies, and they'd have about 2 or 3, and they'd talk about getting buzzed. You know, I have never been buzzed in my life. I am either sober or insanely drunk. There is no in-between. When I read about social drinking in the book, I think, who are they talking about, you know? I never did any of that. So things kind of rocked along. I started getting in trouble real early. I was bad about getting MIPs. I relate a lot to Mike, what he was talking about. He never got DUI. I never got DUIs either. I never had a car. I had one once for a while, but lost it. Anyway, so I was always getting in trouble. I started dating the Justice of the Peace's daughter. You know, I thought, man, that'd keep me out of a little trouble. Later on, I had to move up to the DA's daughter and eventually had to marry her. But that's way later on in the story. But things are rocking along, and I'm the kind of guy, I wasn't afraid of anything. I just was not afraid of anything, and I don't know why. I really should have been. I did a lot of dumb things. I ran off to Mexico one time. I was about 15, and I called my folks from the border and told them I'd be back directly. And it was about a month or so later. It was the worst beating I ever got, but it was the best time I ever had. You know, it was just a ball. And, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, I was out of control. long before we ever had that first talk. But my folks had gone on a vacation, and they were dim enough to let me stay at home by myself. I had little old preacher brother with me, and they sent sister off to grandma. And our house was not very big, y'all. I mean, not very big at all. And I had about 150 of my best friends in there, and we broke every bit of furniture in the house, you know, and just one of those great parties, kind of like an animal house kind of deal. And I'll never forget the look on my folks' face when they walked in the door, and they're asking what happened. I said, you know, we've been here for about 11 years, and I just felt like we need to rearrange a little bit. That's when Mom brought the first faith healer home. And his son was with us that evening, and we did what you're supposed to do. We dropped him off on the front yard and ring the doorbell and all that kind of good stuff. And so preacher come over, and he's giving me the talk. He's giving me the talk, and he's laying hands on me, and he's speaking in tongues, and he's trying to cast that alcohol demon out of me. And he says, boy, do you realize that you are going to hell? And I looked him dead in the eyes, and I said, yes, sir, I do, and I plan on taking as many of you as I can with me. And that healing stopped. He just left. Things kind of rocked along, and I'm doing what I do, and I eventually wind up down at the park. And the park in my hometown is kind of like a lot of East Texas towns. It's just the way it is. It ain't right. It just ain't right. But it's a segregated place, you know. Everybody has their place. And I fit wherever there was a lot of drinking going on. I showed up down there one night. And my best friend, we've become my best friend in the world, his name was Rondell. He was the most cross-eyed man I've ever met in my life. One eye went that way, the other one went that way. And whenever we play basketball, the goal's in front of you, and he's looking like this. He never missed, man. He could have been the next Michael Jordan, but the bull got a hold of him too, you know. And the lady last night was talking about Wild Irish Rose. I love people that drink Wild Irish Rose. The best stuff you ever hadn't seen a Fruit One squoze in it, you know, and it just tastes just like whiskey. I just fell in love with it. Best thing ever happened to me. So I'd stay down there for a few months, and, you know, my brother could get away from the house for, you know, 24 hours, and my folks would go running around looking for him. I'd be gone for 3 weeks. Nobody ever looked for me. That still bothers me, you know what I mean? Now, I didn't want to be found, but I was worth looking for, I thought, you know? So I've been down there for a few months, and things have just, I am just drinking constantly. I'm drinking constantly. Mom had already had that talk with me, one of them crying, sobbing stories. Oh, baby, please don't let it control you. You control it. And by the time that had come around, I had long since overshot that mark. There was nothing I could do about it. She had found me one afternoon and said, boy, you have become notorious. And Mom can say that with about 47 syllables in it, and every one of them hits you in the mouth, you know, and it's awful. She said, you're going to Houston. That's where my dad lived, and he is at least a heavy drinker. Don't know whether he's alcoholic or not. That's his business. But we lived in a wonderful part of town. It's right off of Hammerley, right behind Dee's Pit Stop at the time. And that is the most wonderful bar you've ever met in your life. Some of these guys know what I'm talking about. But she sent me down there because she thought if I was living with my dad and saw what alcoholism was like, I might want to stop. Well, what she didn't know is that she thought she was sending me to the worst place I could be, but it was just like heaven, man. I made some of the best friends I ever met in my life. My best friend when I moved down here, his name was Charlie. Charlie lived in the dumpster next to the bar. He never ate, he never bathed, he never did any of that, and everybody bought his beer. And I thought, you know, growing up, my favorite movies are them country and western movies. Those old drunks, they never have to eat or bathe, and everybody feeds them booze, and that's what I wanted to be when I grew up, you know? Charlie was kind of like Bill W.'s doggerel on the tombstone. He died before the end of the summer of acute alcoholism. He drank himself to death. And I might should have taken a little heed to that, but I didn't. And that's just the way that goes. Me and my dad, we didn't get along too good. I didn't get along too good with anybody. And he tried to cut me off at the bar one evening, and we got in a big to-do. And I'm going to stab him, put him out of his misery, and he's going to beat the crap out of me. And something happened that night, and neither one of us got killed, and that was good because it was going to happen. I'd only been here for a couple of months. He decided it was time for me to go back already. A couple of significant things happened to me at Dee's Pit Stop. There was a guy there named Hacksaw, and I remember walking in to the bar one day, and I used to, back when I was a kid, all I cared about was fighting football and another word that starts with F that I'm not going to say, but you can figure it out, I would imagine. And anyway, my dad always had a Coors Light and a Bourbon Press waiting for me when I got to the bar after I got off work. And I told him, I said, well, you know, today I don't think I want one. I think I'm going to go to the gym and work out a little bit. Because the most important thing in my life was playing ball. That was it. That's what I lived for. I lived for that and whiskey. But I told my dad no, and Hacksaw said, "Boy, I admire you. You have willpower." And I thought about that. And I thought, you know what? He's right. I could probably have a beer and then go on about my business, and you know the rest of the story. I didn't leave the bar the rest of that night nor the rest of the summer, and that's just the way it went. That's just the way it went. Had that big to-do, he sent me back home, and over the summer, I'd worked long enough to save up a little money and bought a car. It was an 87 Camaro. It was beautiful. The most fun thing I ever had. And I made a decision when I was on my way back from Houston that until football season was over with, I was not ever going to take another drink. I wasn't going to do it. I didn't tell anybody this. I just told myself. And so I stopped to get a 12-pack for the ride home. I meant when I got back to town, and I got to that... I got to that four-way stop, and if I'd gone right, it was to the girlfriend's house. If I'd gone left, it was to the liquor store, so I just went left, and then I went right. You know, that deal about not drinking lasted about 5 minutes, you know, about 5 minutes. And got started, got to rocking and rolling, and I got hurt really early on in the season. I wound up separating my shoulder many, many times, and I got to where my arm would just fall out and losing sensation and feeling in my hands. And I was 17, so my folks signed this deal, and the doctor signed this deal, and I couldn't play ball no more. And as far as I was concerned, life was over with. That was it. I am done. I am through. There's no point in living. And I began a real serious attempt at trying to drink myself to death. That's what I was trying to do. I was already, you know, they had kicked me out of the house not long after that, or not long before that. You know, it was one of those things. They had rules. Like, one of their rules was you can't drink and stay here. Well, I had to drink. I had to drink every day. I had to drink every day. I'd gotten to the point where at that period of time I was not welcome anywhere because everybody had rules. Most of them had to do with not drinking. And I started staying in this shed next to a friend of mine's house. I stayed there for a good long while. A good long while I was drinking, a good long while after I got sober. I didn't need to have to be homeless, and you're never really homeless in a small town. Y'all know how that goes. You can always couch crash or something like that, but that's just where I was. I would rather be that away. I just would. I'll never forget walking home one day and walking through the street, and my folks were standing out in the front yard, and they're asking, "Boy, where's that car?" I said, "Man, I have no idea. I lost it. I still got the keys and title to it, but I can't find it. I'm sure it's in some pasture somewhere rotten today, you know." And that's just, those are the kind of things that happen on a real regular basis. I was passed out in my front yard one morning. It was long about December, right before Christmas, and I got 12-step by my neighbor, the old-fashioned way. A lot of folks say you don't talk to a drunk when they're drinking. Well, had they waited for me to sober up, I never would have found this place. He'd come over. It was about 2 or 3 in the morning or something like that, and he hit me on the head, and he said, "Boy, I don't know, but you might have a slight drinking problem." And he said, "Maybe you ought to read this book." And he gave me my first copy, The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And just at that time, my very best friend in the world got sent off to a goonie roost because he was bad about doing that dope and all that stuff and drinking too much. And they sent him off, and I thought, man, I needed a break. I'd gone from 215 pounds down to about 160, 155 in a short period of time, and I was at my whiskey weight, like Mike was talking about last night, just at my whiskey weight. And I'm telling y'all, all I wanted to do was die. All I wanted to do was die. So they took me to the meetings, and I'm going to tell you exactly what I thought at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked around the room, and they had all them signs hanging on the wall, and everybody was so old. And to me, it looked just like a geriatric kindergarten, you know, and I thought, I'm 17 years old at the time, and the youngest guy there is 30, you know. That's double my age. I thought, my God, if I ever got that old, I'd quit drinking too, you know. So I poked along. I visited for about 30 days. I get a desire chip every day. I drink every day. You know how that goes. And I go to school, pass them out like show and tell, you know. And everybody just thought it was so wonderful. Somebody going to AA. After about 30 days, they had enough of me. And that's no joke. Because I did a research paper one time. I knew there was something wrong with me. I figured out why I was alcoholic. I inherited it or something. You know, I could tell you the chromosome number and color and all that neat scientific stuff, and I just tell them all about it, and they didn't care. You know how they are. Sit down, shut up, boy. They didn't want to know anything about it. So one evening after a meeting, they had their fill, and about four or five of them were standing on the porch, and they said, "Boy, what you need to do is go try some controlled drinking." I said, man, that sounds wonderful. What is it? And they said, well, it's on page 31, but since you probably can't read, we're just going to tell you. And so they told me, and my buddies rolled by, and I jumped in the back of the truck and went to that old party, and I did what they said to do. I had about 6 beers, 2 shots, and when you were drinking the way I was drinking, that didn't do nothing for you. The next day, I got up, had a few more, just absolutely miserable. And on Sunday, you know what I said? To heck with it. And I started drinking like I like to drink. And that began a six-month period of just, only way I know to describe it, is zombolic drinking. I have no idea what happened, where I was, what was going on, or anything like that. I have no idea. Couldn't tell you. Couldn't tell you where I was, who I was with, nor did I care. And that was the thing. I just didn't care anymore. I just didn't care. A lot of bad things were happening. I mean, if it could have got worse, it did. And everything I ever said I was never going to do happened in that period of time. I had stopped by the house one evening, and I needed to pick up some money and steal some money from my brother is what I was doing. And mom standing in front of the door trying to block it, keep me from getting out. And she's just begging and crying, baby, please stay here. Please stay here. And what do you do when your mom is standing in front of you, begging you and crying, telling you to stay? You just throw her out of the way. That's what I did when I drank. That's what I did. And you go on about your business. And I'll never forget that day. I'll never forget a lot of days, but there's a whole lot of stuff like that that went on. We got this big senior trip planned to Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. In my graduating class, there were 106 of us, you know, and that's not very big. Everybody knew everybody's first, last name. We'd known each other our whole lives, and that's just kind of the way it was. And I'd said a prayer before I left that last meeting where they told me about controlled drinking. I believe it was the most sincere prayer I ever said in my life. And I said, God, either let me die or make me want to have what these people have. That was it. That's what I wanted. And we're out doing what you do when you're from the country. I was drinking with one of my coaches, and we picked up a bunch of pretty girls, and we're on these back roads, and we're swerving and ducking and dodging, and we're in this brand new 1994 Pathfinder, and it starts to roll. And when it starts to roll, the thought that goes through my mind is, thank God it's over. Thank God it's over. And I wasn't dead, you know, obviously. And I was disappointed. And I thought to myself, this is my sign from God. This is it. I will never drink again as long as I live. We got everybody back to town, and within 15 minutes, we were out there getting all the bottles that hadn't broken and the cans that hadn't busted. And I finished that drunk just like you're supposed to. I was bad about not being where I was supposed to be, like school. They expected it on a regular basis. I didn't do that. My mom was there one morning. She said, boy, I'm here about your attendance. How many days do you think you missed? I said, well, probably about 10 or 11. And we got to the office, more like 43. And that's not good, because that's like half of the deal, you know, and you're not going to get to graduate. But they worked something out where I'd had to go to detentions like before and after school every day on Saturday and go out to the vice principal's house on Sunday and bale hay and do those kind of things. That's just the way it works. By the time I was 15, I'm going to slide back a little bit. Like I said, I was going to the Justice of the Peace on a regular basis, and he called me the town drunk, and I was so proud. And he taught me how to get around all that stuff. He said, God, boy, would you just put all that stuff in a suitcase, go to one pasture, and stay all night, you know? Because that's where you drink when you're from the country, in the pasture. There's no bars or any of that kind of stuff. And just go out there and raise cane, burn stuff down. It's wonderful, you know? And we did it real good. Everybody in town knew what happened by the time I woke up the next morning. That was one of the other deals. I had to go set up the whole deal for graduation and stuff like that. And people are asking me, what happened, Joe? Are you okay? What's going on? And I didn't remember a thing. They took me by the car later on that afternoon, and I just couldn't believe anybody survived that wreck. I really couldn't. It was amazing. And every one of us walked away. We got through that deal, got my little diploma and all that stuff, and I got on a good run of drunk. I wound up somewhere down in Corpus Christi or Robstown or something like that, and I vaguely remember being at a quinceañera or some big Mexican party, and it was great, man, because they had tons of tequila and tons of rum, and it just couldn't have been any better. I fit right in. We had a few days left before we were supposed to get on that flight, and every bit of money I'd gotten for graduation and everything else was gone, and by the time it was time to make that trip to the airport, I remember why I had this. I have no idea. It might have been some women involved, but I had this box of wine, and it was about empty, and you know how that stuff is. You got to rip the box apart, and on the way to the airport, I'm squeezing on that bladder, pulling on that little deal trying to get that last little drop out because I was afraid they weren't going to serve me on the airplane, and that was true. When we got there, my mom was there, girlfriend was there, her mom, everybody I knew in this God's world was there, and everybody was, well, my mom and her mom and her, everybody was crying, Joe, please don't drink. Please don't drink till the last day. Please, 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 baby, don't do it. Don't do it. All right, I won't do it. But I fell in love. There was this girl that I believe she danced for a living, and I fell in love right away with her and her friend, and that's just my kind of deal. So I left the girlfriend and everything else, and I'm running around trying to do what I need to do. And we get down to this resort thing. I remember trying to sign in. They wouldn't let me drink on the plane, and I was right. I started getting into them bad shakes, and I was shaking so bad I couldn't sign my name on a little piece of paper. My buddies are holding my hand. They're saying, Joe, you got to stop drinking, man. And this orientation deal lasted about 15 minutes. I was good for two. And went to the bar, and the first thing I did was order a glass of tequila. Then I asked for some rum. And when I drink rum, things get stupid in a hurry. I mean real stupid. You know, where I grew up, there's lots of trees, and you can kind of go to the bathroom everywhere you want to go. In Mexico, they're a little bit smaller. And, well, I was using one, and I missed. And I hit somebody's table while they were eating, and that didn't go over so well. And then I guess I had to go again real soon, so I just used the pool. And that didn't go over real well either, and the little bartender cut me off. I got angry, so I tried to beat him to death with a bar stool. And they locked me up in the room. They thought maybe I need to take a break. Maybe if I get a little sleep, it might wear off a little bit. And later on that afternoon, the sleep wasn't helping none. They brought me back down and thought if I get some food in my stomach, I might sober up a little bit. And that's when I saw my opportunity. I was going to kill myself. So I grabbed somebody's drink as I'm making my way out to the ocean, and I'm just going to drown myself out there. And I got about 400 or 500 yards out, and the water never got above my chest. And my buddies are chasing after me, and they're dragging me back into shore. And just in case you're wanting to kill yourself in Mexico, don't do it in public. It's against the law. I know that because the federales were passing by, and they were ready to take me in. And they convinced them to let me just go back to the room, and I'm standing there screaming and yelling and cussing at them, telling them to go back to their own country and leave me alone. And don't they know who I am? Having no idea where I'm at. And I have another opportunity. I'm gonna jump off the balcony and get to town. And I would have made it had I opened the sliding glass door, but I didn't. It was plexiglass. That knocked me down for a bit. And that was good. And I come to, and I was in the best fight I'd ever seen in my life. Everybody just beating the crap out of me and looked like they were having fun. I wasn't. I was under room arrest, you know, but the guards give up later on into the evening. I made my way to them girls, see what I could do with that, and find me some more whiskey. And I remember coming to the next morning because that's what I'd been doing for a long time. I'd been shaking awake at about 4 or 5:30, just having to take another drink, and that's what happened one more time. And I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it. And I got down to the main floor, and they had a little bus waiting for me and a couple of police cars, and I was being deported from Mexico, for Christ's sake. How do you get thrown out of Mexico, you know? That's hard to explain. So, you know, you get on the bus, and you get going. And got to the airport, I tried to make it to the bar, and that didn't work out so good, and I saw the biggest man in any shape, form you've ever seen. He was my bodyguard, and three times bigger than Bobby, and that's pretty big. And anyway, they take me out to the plane on my very own bus, one more little bus by myself, and I got my bodyguard, and he's sitting next to me on the plane, and all these important people are loading me up, shipping me out, and this poor old woman sat next to me on the plane ride back, and I know I just reeked because I hadn't bathed in days, and I'd been hard drinking like I like to drink, and I remember just crying. Every time I asked for help, it was always a stipulation to it. That evening, there was no stipulation, or that morning, I just said, God help, and that's all I could get out of my mouth, God help. Didn't know what to do, got back to the airport. My mom standing there crying one more time. My stepdad standing there laughing. He's a big shot administrator at one of the oldest treatment centers in Dallas at the time. And he asked me a real important question. One thing I got to say, this one of the guys that kind of headed up the trip and a couple of the chaperone people were asking me right before they sent me off. They said, Joe, why do you drink like you drink? Why do you do this? why do you always do this? And I told the absolute truth that morning. It was the first time, probably last time I've ever told the absolute truth in my life. I said, you know, I don't know why I do what I do. And that wasn't a sufficient answer for a non-alcoholic. They don't understand that. You can come in here and say, I don't know, and we all get it. We know you don't know why you do what you do. They want answers, you know, like who, what, when, where, why. Those are just lie questions, you know. If you ask me, I'm just going to lie to you just for the principle of the thing. Like, where you been? Who you been with? I don't know, you know. What do you want to hear? You know what I mean? What's going to make you feel better about all of it? So that's what I'm going to tell you. Get back, my dad says, well, what do you think we ought to do with you? I said, well, you take me to jail. I know I got warrants out some kind of place, or maybe we can go to that treatment center you work at. And he looked me dead in the eyes, and he said, boy, you ain't worth the money. And I said, well, what about AA? He said, that's the best idea you've ever had. And so they did a little rolling stop at the meeting, dropped me off. And when they said, don't bother coming home. And I said, don't worry, I ain't. And walked through the glass door, and the lady was sitting there. Her granddaughter was in my graduating class, and the whole room just busted out laughing because they knew where I was supposed to be. And I just blubbering and whining and crying, didn't know what to do. And I didn't pick up a desire chip that night. They stuffed me full of a lot of cigarettes. Nobody offered me a ride anywhere, home or anything like that. They just turned me loose when the meeting was over with because they didn't like me very much. And I don't blame them. I had a tough decision to make. I didn't know what to do. And I walked by the liquor store, and it just happened to be a Sunday. It was closed. I couldn't get nothing. So I walked around town all day, and one of the gifts I'd received for graduation was round-trip tickets anywhere I wanted to go. So I flew to Houston. I figured if anybody could help me out, maybe my dad could. Because I wasn't wanted where I was at, and I just needed to get gone. I do that a lot. When I ain't wanted where I'm at, I just get gone. Sometimes I just get gone because I need to. I like to run a lot, and that ain't so good. Best lesson I ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is sometimes it's just best stand up and be counted. And that's okay. That's okay. That's the greatest lesson I've ever learned here. A lot about becoming a man. But anyway, made my trip down to Houston. I knew he'd help me get off of drunk, and he did. Fed me a lot of orange juice and honey and stuff like that, and I shook it out for a good 3 days. And every time I laid down in this little old bed, you know, it's a drunk house, and there ain't no furniture. There's just beds set up everywhere. And I remember every time I'd lay down, I felt like I was falling into hell, and the walls and the ceilings was shaking and moving on me, and stuff was crawling out of the carpet, and I was having my first real good shot at DT. It was great. A free trip, I guess. I don't know what to tell you. He had this little bottle of tequila on the wall. It said break in case of emergency. It was enclosed in glass, and I studied that thing for 3 hours trying to figure out, is this an emergency or not, you know? And, you know. Wound up not drinking it, called my folks, said, hey, look, can I come back to Kauffman? And because I didn't know that AA was anywhere but in Kauffman in Dallas, Texas. I thought that's the only place it existed, and I needed to get back. I needed to get back there. They said, you can come back to town, but you can't come home, and I said, that's fine. Started going to meetings on a regular basis, and the first night I was back, they took me into the back room. And if you're getting took to the back room, you're going to a good place if you're ready to stop drinking. And they give me that talk. It's about four or five of them. They said, there are going to be some conditions for you here. And one condition is you cannot say anything until we ask you to. And I said, okay. They said, you're going to have a case of sugar diabetes. Said, what you need to do is keep you some candy and something sweet around and have you something to get you through the shake. Because I shook awful bad for a long time. It was a good 6 months before I could hold a full cup of coffee without spilling it. And they said, you're going to get a sponsor. And they gave me a sponsor. His name was Head. Head was a real hillbilly. He had hair way down past his neck, you know, and he quit school in the sixth grade. And he only had about 9 months at the time. But they figured if he worked, there was no way I was going to stay sober. But if he worked with me, it might help him out. And that's how that whole deal worked. It worked out real good because Head didn't know nothing, you know. We just got started on the book. And he didn't read so well. So what we would do to work the steps is get together and I'd tell him what the big words meant, and he'd tell me what to do. And we started right at that front blank page, you know. And there, it wasn't like it kind of is in some of the big cities where they talk about working a step a month or a step a year or anything like that. If you're well enough to stop shaking and you can read the book, you're ready to start working the steps. That's just the way they felt about it. They said all we had to offer in Alcoholics Anonymous was a spiritual experience. And the only way they knew to produce that was with the steps. So you get started right away. We got going. You know, we got going. We got to work on it. And a little bit of time had passed, and things were kind of going good, and I was out at his house. He was trying to get me on the third step, and I was trying to do it by myself. I kept coming back and telling him, you know, nothing's happening. I thought something big was supposed to happen. So we were out of his place one day, and before things had really gotten good in his life, he lived in this old 70 trailer. He had built five extra rooms onto, you know, and every broke-down vehicle he ever had, and it was just the way it ought to be. Broke-down horse, and we're pitching horseshoes, and we go over to the butane tank. That's where the tea is. He said, boy, get on your knees. I said, I didn't sign up for nothing like this. And that's exactly what I said. Now, he got on his too, thank God, and he reached under that butane tank, and he pulled out a big book, and he had it planned out, you know. And he said, looky here, God. He told me, he said, we're fixing to do this third step. He said, looky here, God. Smokey Joe's fixing to turn his will of life over to you, so watch out. And he said, boy, read that prayer. And I read that prayer. I'm going to tell you something. Something happened that day. By the time I was finished, I felt like if I turned around, Jesus, Muhammad, Buddha, or somebody would have been standing right behind me. Something happened that day. Something changed. And immediately after getting up, he said, boy, you need to go home and do that fourth step right now. Well, you know how that goes. You get flushed with that old spiritual enema, and you ain't ready to do nothing. I'm hanging out for 2 weeks, and I'm sitting on the back table at the back door, and he said, you got that fourth step done yet? And I said, no, sir. I was real arrogant, kind of like I am now, maybe a little worse. I said, Head, I don't think I want to know everything it is to know about me just yet. So he grabbed me by the arm, threw me in his pickup truck, and we went down to the liquor store. Walked inside, he got a fifth of Jack Daniels, came back out, set it in my lap. He said, well, the problem is, boy, you hadn't had enough to drink yet. Why don't you just get with it? I said, I'll have it done Sunday. That was Friday night. Wrote it, got it done. I was out at his place doing my best shot at a fourth and fifth step. And I'm going to tell you something. I did the very best I could do at the time. That's the God's honest truth. Was everything on there? No. It wasn't. I made a fatal mistake, though. Almost a fatal mistake. I willfully withheld one piece of information. One thing I was never going to tell another human being as long as I lived. It was going to be many, many more years before I ever talked about any of that stuff. And it was no big deal, you know. It was just one of those things I was just going to go to my grave with. I just was. Things rocked along. My life is getting good. You know, I started out working for this gentleman. He had a detail shop. Started working for him, you know, for cigarettes and food. That's how I got started. They helped me get a little job at a construction company and all that kind of good stuff. I was a laborer. I cleaned and swept. That's what I did. And eventually things moved on. I got a job working on a drilling rig, taking soil samples, going everywhere. And I got to go all over the Midwest and all this kind of stuff. And, man, it was wonderful. I got to make meetings everywhere. And I got to find out how big AA was. And it wasn't a town I went to that I didn't catch a meeting. I called 911 at one place. Got the police showed up and everything. And they thought I was drunk. I said, no, I just need to find the AA. And so they took me. It was great. It was great. Only call they ever had like that, they said. It was the only free ride I ever had in a black police car, too. You know? But it was cool. It was cool. Met a guy at that meeting. His God was a cricket. He kept it in his pocket in a plastic bag. You know, that was God as he understood him. And it worked, you know. He was sober. He was all kinds of nuts in AA. I know I'm one of them. I'm dying to go back to see if the dude's still sober. You know what I mean? Anybody going Texarkana way, let me know. I'm riding, you know. Things are going good. For the first 3 or 4 months, all I wore to the meetings were cut-off shorts. No shirts, no shoes, no none of that. That's no joke. And they kept inviting me back. And they gave me a key. They gave me a key after I had 2 months. And I was so proud of that. You know, I still don't even have a key to my mother's house. And it's been almost 12 years since I've had a drink. At the last birthday, I said, Mom, can I have a key? She said, oh, baby, I don't know. I'm going to have to pray about it a little bit. I know what Jesus is going to say. Lord. Things are going good. I got this job. I bought me this little bitty old pickup truck, and I'm 18 now. Got from the 17 to 18, and I was driving home from school. This brand new 1994 black Ford Ranger. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever had in my life, the only thing I'd ever had in my life. And I was coming home. I was trying to make a quick trip back from Oklahoma City, and I was coming into town, and there was a huge harvest moon. This is about 10 months into it. This huge harvest moon sitting over the tree line, and it dawned on me for the first time I had gone the entire day without thinking about drinking. Because early on, no matter what I did, I wanted to drink every single day. And the only hour of peace I had was in the AA meeting. It's the only time my mind stopped. The rest of the time, I just wanted to drink. I was doing everything I was supposed to do, giving it my best shot. And but that's what happened. And the next thought that came to my mind was, God, I'm old. I don't drink. I ain't got nothing going on. What I need to do is get married. And because my wife's over, might as well do that too. She wanted to... First wife wanted to go to school to be a court reporter and all that kind of stuff. Her folks would pay for her to go to college, but they wouldn't support her in doing that, so I wasn't making any money. She wasn't either. So figured you would get a bunch of financial aid, and that worked out pretty good for her. And she went to school to become a court reporter. We moved to Fort Worth, moved to the big city. And I'll never forget moving up there. I was driving down Lamar Street, and there were these two blondes in a car next to me, and they're both smiling. I thought, God, the city life is going to be good for me, you know. And then it kind of dawned on me. I had everything in the back of a trailer and all in my truck, and my rocking chair was tied to the top. I looked just like the Beverly Hillbillies coming to town. They wasn't smiling at me. They were laughing at me, you know. Or I sobered up. All these meetings are closed. There's all closed meetings. We got one open meeting a month. Everything comes out of literature. There is no open discussion. You know, it's not, no meeting to start with, I'm having a bad day. You know, we just don't talk about that stuff. It comes out of the literature. It's just the way it was. So I thought everywhere in AA was really kind of like that. And I moved to the city, and I make this meeting. I say it when I'm there. It's the primary purpose group in Arlington, and they were talking about their inner child. Now, we had this one guy come in. He was going to therapy, and I've got nothing against therapy. It's a wonderful thing. You need to go. The book talks about all that outside professional help. However, inside the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's no help to us. But he had come in with a teddy bear, and we were all asking him, why you got that teddy bear? My therapist said, I need to work on my inner child. And Ken was a big, big guy, and he was bald, looked just like Mr. Clean. He said, no, let me tell you what we're going to do with that teddy bear. And he ripped it in half, ripped the head off, threw it in the trash. He said, what you need to work on is the SOB you are right now, and all you need to know about your inner child is it needs this butt whooped. So I think that's how you handle business. When people talk about that, I'm at this meeting, I stand up and start doing that. And that don't go over very well. They don't appreciate that kind of stuff. So now I'm living in Fort Worth. I'm having to drive all the way back every day to catch a meeting. I finally asked this guy, is there any real AA in Fort Worth? He says, yeah, there is. There's this place called the Meadowbrook Group, and you need to go find one of two people, a gentleman by the name of Jack H. or Jim S. I met Jim S. the first night. He was a real good guy. He was kind of like Grandpa, except with about 30 years, real steady. Steady guy, just a good person. He's kind of people that make you sick in AA. They come here and you think, man, how'd that person ever take a drink? You just don't believe it. Then I met Jack. Jack's a little bit different. He's kind of shady and shifty, and he's my kind of guy, you know. So I asked him one evening after the meeting, I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, absolutely not. He said, I don't sponsor dope heads. I said, I have never done any of that stuff in my life. I said, I am a whiskey drinker. He goes, God, you're young. And he's like 64 or something at the time. And he kept saying no, and I said, well, look, I've been thrown out of an entire country. And he got quiet for a second. He said, well, I've never sponsored anybody who got thrown out of a country, son. I'll take you. And that's how that deal worked out. We got talking about them full moons and them girls, and you know what? There was no difference between him and me. No difference between him and me. A lot of people say, oh, well, you can have a great impact on young people because they can relate and all that kind of stuff. That may be true. May not. I kind of don't believe so. I kind of believe if you're an alcoholic, you're an alcoholic. I think if you can identify with the first 164 pages, you can identify with anybody in this room. And that's what it's really about. Don't matter about the age. Don't matter about the color. Don't matter about no orientation like Hall likes to talk about all the time. You know, none of that stuff matters. It just don't matter. What do you want to do about stopping drinking? That's the deal. And if you're willing to do the work, you'll get the results. Things worked out real good. Like I said, I was married at this point, but I was married when I went home, if you know what I mean. And whenever I would leave the house, I'd take my little old ring off and all that kind of stuff and try to work them groups, and sponsor found out about that. And so he announced to everybody I was married, and right before I made a talk one evening, and then he said that my wife had to go to Al-Anon. I said, oh, no, huh? I've got her trained just right. You know, she gets up in the morning, cooks breakfast, irons my clothes, does all that kind of stuff just like a good East Texas woman is supposed to do. And I don't want this to change. Well, it changed rapidly after about two meetings. My life got on a total different basis. She had to get up real early. Like I said, by this time I'd gotten into the insurance business, and that was real good because I was good about, you know, all you got to do that is take their money and promise to give them something later when they're dead. This is wonderful, you know. I can do that. I can do that kind of thing. I'm good at that. You con anybody, you know. So I'm doing this kind of gig now, and everything's going pretty good. And anyway, this button had fallen off top of my shirt, and it wasn't ironed or pressed or anything, and she's heading out the door. I said, whoa, where are you going? You need to fix this button and iron this shirt. And she gave me a one-finger salute from the middle, signifying how number one I was, and said that she would never iron or touch a piece of my clothes as long as I lived. And the rest of the time we were married, she didn't. But things improved after that, actually. I kind of started having to treat her like an equal, and that helps the marriage relations, I don't mind telling you. Things rocked along pretty good for a while. Like I said, I had this just wayward eye, and I acted on it from time to time, and eventually I got caught. I was, this is how I met all these people from Houston. I was at a state convention, and a gentleman came up, said he wanted me to meet his daughter and all that kind of deal, and I'm happy to oblige him, and things happened, and my wife found out about me staying over someplace I shouldn't have been, doing some stuff I shouldn't have been doing, and that kind of blew the deal. And I'm not proud of any of that. It's just, you know, it's the truth. It's just the truth. I could not act right. Would not act right. So she packs everything up and leaves like she's supposed to. There was no reconciliation. There was no trying. There was no nothing. And that's just the way it went. That's the way it went. I got to do the right thing against my own will. See, my sponsor sponsored me. His wife sponsored her, so everybody knew my business, man. I couldn't keep nothing quiet, and that's never good. That's never good. But I got to do the right thing, and that deal got to be settled a little bit. But that began about a 2.5-year run in dry drunk. The only thing I didn't do for the next 2.5 years was drink. I began living that double life like the book talks about. I was doing what I wanted to do. I was two-stepping. I was doing step one and step 12. I believed I was powerless over alcohol, and I'd help anybody else get out from under, but I wasn't working anything in the middle, you know, the meat. So it makes life difficult. Got back on my feet. Everything's going okay, and I'm at my new place, and I've got furniture again and all that kind of stuff. Sister comes over to have some coffee, and we're going to talk, and she said, Bubba, how long have you been drinking? I said, what are you talking about? She said, there's no way anybody can be living the way you've been living and not be drinking. I said, no, I haven't had a drink. And the heat was on. See, if my sister ain't real bright, but if she knows what's going on, everybody else must too. So I got to go. I got to get out of town. And I split. I split. Had an opportunity to come to Houston, been in the carpet business for a long time, selling to apartments and all that good stuff. And that was great because, you know, all you work with women, you got to drive around, smile, and flirt all day. It's a good deal, you know. You just don't get no better than that when you're young and just crazy. So took an opportunity to come down here to get away. I'd stopped at the bank. That evening sponsor was telling me, boy, I don't think it's time for you to go. I don't think you're ready. His wife was saying, Claudia was saying, I don't think it's time for you to go. I think you're running. I said, you don't know what you're talking about. So what I did was I made a stop. I'd gone to the bank, got every bit of little money I had out, and I was going to go to Mexico that night, and I was going to finish the deal. I was going to drink myself to death. That's what I was going to do. So I made a stop at the Bay Area Club because I knew Danny and I knew Bill W. and a couple of other people. Now I told myself if Danny's there and Bill's there, I might stay for the meeting. And both of them were there when I walked in the door. They were both there when I walked in the door. It was the most amazing thing I ever seen in my life. I sat down at this table. The guy named Big Al cussed at me immediately, never having met him before in my life. And I thought, my God, I'm at home. You know, that's how that deal worked. Walter and Bill A. and Al invited me out to dinner that night. I went and had supper with them, and I was too tired to drive, so I figured I'd wait till the morning. And I did what I do every day when I woke up the next morning. I called my sponsor because I've been calling him every single day since I've been sober. Whether I catch him or not, leave a message, talk to him. We don't talk about AA very much. We just talk. And I called Bill, and I said, hey, look, man, I need a sponsor. I need to go through the steps. And that was Halloween. That was Halloween. By the time Thanksgiving rolled around, oh, yeah. I told that one thing I was never going to tell. Let me tell you something. My life changed almost immediately because now I was even. Now I had really done what I was supposed to do. I was gut level honest with myself, God, and another human being. And that's what I needed to do. And that changed my life. You know, I'd been talking about all this stuff for years. Running around telling my story, this and that, blah, 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 blah. But I wasn't working it, you know. I just wasn't. I was half-stepping it. Things changed after that in a hurry, in rapid succession. Wound up getting to sponsor a lot of good people and stuff like that, and everything changed. And I made the tour of Texas, made amends to everybody I'd messed over in sobriety. And that is a lot more difficult than making that first round. Because, you know, you ain't got nothing to hang it on. Ain't got nothing to hang it on, but I'm a sorry human being. You know, that's how I live. I lived wrong. It just wasn't right. And but I got to make all that stuff right. And nothing's left undone right now. I got to make my 10-year anniversary not long ago, and my ex-wife was there and her husband and the kids, and it was great to go with an even slate and all that stuff. It was just wonderful. I was at a concert one night with some friends of mine, and this blonde walked by, and I said, man, I'm going to have to try that out. And it turns out she was a backsliding Al-Anon and came up and talked to some of the people I knew and stuff like that. And she was married at the time, and I always kind of like a dirty deal, you know, just something about half wrongs right, you know what I'm saying? So we got slipping around on the side and all that good stuff and wound up getting married eventually. So I always do things backwards, wrong, and fast, you know. That's just kind of how that goes. They hadn't fixed me quite yet. But anyway... got to get married. She's a wonderful lady. She had a great job. Everything was going good. And she came home one day and said, I want to pursue my dream in life. I said, that's wonderful. What is it? She said, I want to be a marriage and family therapist. And I said, oh, my God. And so she quit her great job and started going to school full time. And she's just happy as can be. And it's fun to be able to live and let live. I think our whole marriage is based on one thing, and that's solid constructive imperfection. We have a few short rounds every now and then, a few long rounds every now and then. That's just the way it goes. It's by no means perfect or anything like that, but it works for us. It's kind of really abnormal, I think. But what are you going to do? It is what it is. She lets me be, and I let her be most of the time, and it works out pretty good. I have an amazing life. I really do. I was home a couple of weeks ago, and I drove by that shed that I used to live in. And it's still there. And that park bench I used to stay on, it's still there. See, nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. Except me. And God made that possible through Alcoholics Anonymous and you people. In that order. If you want to know what, I'm going to tell you what I believe the biggest secret and the most wonderful thing about AA is. And it's very simple to me. It's the people. It's the people. That's where I hear the message. That's where I get my answers. It's from you. It's from you. When I was trying to get that inventory stuff done I was talking about, there was a gentleman named Iron Mike. The guy that spoke last night. Every time Iron Mike speaks, he said, I'm grateful God showed me mercy instead of justice. And that's what I was looking for. That's what I was looking for. Because justice is what I deserved, and it was coming my way. And I knew it. And I did what I was supposed to do. And I got mercy. I just did. Every day is not a bed of roses. My life isn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. But it is a far cry from what it should be. And where I come from and all that kind of stuff. I'm grateful for you people. I wouldn't know what to do without you. I just wouldn't. All I had to do when I got here was go to meetings. The only place I had to go. You know what? It's still the only place I got to go. And I love every minute of it. I love giving back. I love giving back. They told me early on that gratitude was an action word. And if you're grateful, you'll get off your anatomy and do something about it. You know? I don't cuss behind the podium. Really wish I could say what I wanted to say right there. But you get off your rear end, you do something about it if you're grateful. Jason and I had the opportunity, we get to do the Wheelhouse Big Book study on Monday nights, and it's a blast. Most nights on the way down, me and him talk about it all the time, we don't feel like going. But you know, when you leave, you feel like $1 million, man. You feel like $1 million. Because it ain't about looking down or looking up or anything like that. It's just about being even. It's about being with your own people. And my favorite thing in the world to do is just sitting down with another wet drunk. It's just great. And a lot of folks are good at service work. A lot of folks are good at this and that. If there's anything in the world to do, I'd rather just sit in front of a wet drunk and talk. hey, man, I know what you're going through. I've been there. I've done that. You can get out from under. I got a second chance. I got a chance. All you old people get to say, I got a second chance life. Well, I didn't get a second chance. I just got one, period. You know, I got off to a bad start. Didn't look like it was ever going to get any better. And you guys have made all the difference. I love each and every one of you. I mean that with all my heart. I really do. If there was anything in the world I could do for you, I would. Wouldn't be no question about it. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.